Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week. Morning, everybody. Whether you're joining us online or here on our campus, it's great to see you guys. I just want to say welcome to Sunday morning here at Sunridge. If you're new here, my name's Britt. I serve here as the lead pastor. And it's been a great 10 years plus, so thank you for sticking around. Next Sunday, as Jed said, is Easter, and it's a great opportunity to invite somebody to church. About 80% of the people that you'll ask will say yes, statistically, so it's a great chance to expose people to the gospel and what's happening here at Sunridge. In October of 1995, I found myself at my father's condo in Melbourne, Florida. And I was picking up a few things for him to take to his hospital room. He had just been diagnosed with cancer and had undergone a major surgery. In his retirement, my dad was a teacher. When he retired, he started competing in triathlons. And on the wall in front of where I was sitting at his desk, there were all these pictures. The wall was covered in photos of like his different races. And one in particular was a race that he had just won in September, the month before I was sitting there. And now at 66, he was fighting for his life. And he was dead by January. Since that time, Cindy and I have lost all of our parents. Then there are some of what were my best friends from childhood. In my mid-40s, I got a call that my high school friend Frank, who was also a pastor, had a sudden headache as he was in a drive-thru to order a hamburger, and it ended up being a brain bleed. And he was gone just a few years later, or a few days later, leaving behind his wife Sandy, who was a friend of mine from elementary school, and two teenage kids. And then his wife Sandy later contracted a disease much like ALS. And just a few short years ago, I had my last conversation with her via FaceTime, and she passed shortly thereafter. Then there's who was my best friend since seventh grade, Mark Trotter. I've talked about him before. We called him the Trot. And we went to the same middle school. I might have told this story before, but we met for the first time on Miami Beach, where he and I hung out all day pool hopping. Now, if you don't know what pool hopping is, that's where teenagers sneak in from the beachside of the swanky hotels, and then we swim in their pools and dance to their live bands and eat the food of the buffet they put out for their guests until we get thrown out. And we just go to the next hotel. And after that, we were inseparable. And as adults, we actually served in two churches together. He's spoken for us here together, but for Sunridge. In 2020, I got a call from Mark, and he said, hey, Blood, we used to call each other Blood. I thought I needed to call you to let you know that the Trots has cancer, and it ain't looking too good. And he passed in February of 2021. Then there's most recently my friend Jerry. He and Jennifer have been at Sunridge for many, many years, and Jerry died of a sudden heart attack in the spring of 2024. So we live in a broken world. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, where suffering and death are inescapable. I can't tell you how many memorials I performed in my over 30 years here at Sunridge. I just did two this past week. Now, each of us eventually face the heartache of loss, the anguish of separation from loved ones. And death isn't the only way this world can leave us heartbroken and anxious. I look out over our audience today and I see many of you that I've done memorials for family members for you. But I see others that you've gone through long illnesses, you've experienced divorce, long-term unemployment, financial strain, worry about your kids. And isn't it true that in the moments where, in those moments, we find ourselves wondering, is God paying attention? And if he is, does he even care? And if he cares, why isn't he doing something? You know, when all the pieces of life are falling together, we tend to forget God. But when it seems like our lives are falling apart, we tend to question God. Isn't that right? Even blame him sometimes. So we're in a study of the Gospel of John today, and in chapter 11, we're going to see people facing some of the deepest of human grief and the greatest fears, the death of a dear brother and friend, Lazarus. And this event leads us, it's the seventh miracle or sign of Jesus' supernatural authority that John reveals. I mean, and then who doesn't remember from Sunday school, if you grew up in church, that great passage of scripture that they did on flannel graph for you, where Jesus stood outside the tomb and said, "Come forth, Lazarus," right? So today what we're going to do is we're going to take a Google Earth view of chapter 11 of John, and then we're going to zoom in to our lives here in the Temecula Valley. So first of all, verses 1 through 16, Lazarus dies. And we know from the passage that Steve just read that Jesus is traveling with his disciples east of the Jordan River when he receives word from Mary and her sister Martha that their brother Lazarus is sick. And by the way, that Mary and Martha, it is. Martha is the one who gave Jesus a hard time because Mary wasn't helping with hosting of their guests in their home. She was sitting at the feet of Jesus. And their brother Lazarus is a dear friend of Jesus, verse 2. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." So Jesus had a special relationship with these siblings, John says, verse 5. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus because their home, we know, was often a refuge for Jesus. So these are dear friends of Jesus, which makes his response to this news somewhat confusing. Verse 6, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. So Jesus doesn't seem to be in any hurry. He and his disciples are likely about a day and a half walk from where Lazarus is. So if you put the whole timeline together here, considering later when Jesus arrives in Bethany, when they say that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days, Lazarus is likely already dead when Jesus hears of his illness. And even though it could appear that it is as if Jesus is unaffected by the news, we're going to soon see that that's not the case. And so he assures them in verse 4, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Lazarus may be dead, but he's not going to stay dead. Jesus has a plan that often, like us, the people in that time and their limited human intelligence are capable of understanding. So when Jesus decides it's time to go to Bethany, the disciples are alarmed. Verse 8, "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?" Remember, the Pharisees had this, they wanted to take Jesus' life. They wanted to be rid of him. And yeah, you got that right if you're just joining us. Religious leaders plotting murder. It is a sad commentary on how convoluted faith can become when power and control and wealth become the true objects of faith. This danger is so imminent that Thomas says out loud what they're probably all thinking. Verse 16, let us also go that we may die with him. In other words, this is probably a suicide mission. And it's noteworthy, I think, this is Thomas, the doubting Thomas, right? Who is so bold here. Thomas is not exactly known for his great faith, but you can see he's loyal, right? And then in verses 17 through 37, Jesus arrives there in Bethany. And we see that Jesus was right when he said Lazarus is dead in verse 17. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. And there were a lot of Jewish customs associated with the death of a loved one in the first century. First of all, the home could expect tons of visitors, family and friends, neighbors, co-workers would come to mourn. And even, this was such an important time of mourning in the first century that sometimes the wealthy people actually hired mourners to come so that people would have this sense that this was a great person that had passed. And sometimes in the homes, they would take all the furniture and push it toward the walls and turn it toward the wall so that when mourners came, they had nowhere to sit. And they would sit on the ground in their mourning in the house. The climate there didn't allow for much delay. So on the day of death, the person who had passed, they would take their body and they would wrap it in these spice-soaked linens that could weigh up to 75 to 100 pounds. And then they would be placed in a tomb, hewn out of a cave or a rock, and they would be placed on a ledge within that cave. And Jewish tradition in the first century taught that the soul lingered around the body for 3 days, hoping to re-enter. But upon seeing the decay set in, it would give up hope and depart. And John tells us that as Jesus neared Bethany, the mourners that had arrived at the house, they saw Jesus on their way in, and they tell Mary and Martha he's going to arrive soon. So Martha, not one to sit on her hands for what needs to be done, rushes off to see Jesus. Verse 20, when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed home. So we see Mary and Martha true to their personalities as we understand them. Martha is the one to act quickly, and Mary's instinct is to be still. And when Martha gets to Jesus, her heart just bursts through her lips. Lord, verse 21, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And she had been able to hold on for a few days, but now in seeing Jesus, she can no longer contain herself. And Jesus comforts her in verse 23. He says, your brother will rise again. And she misunderstands this. She believes that he's speaking of the future resurrection of the faithful. Most Jews at this time believed in a second life after their earthly one, but the Sadducees were the exception. That's why they were called the Sadducees. Because they didn't believe in heaven. That's a preacher joke. I'm glad you got it, because Jed actually told that same joke a few weeks ago, and I thought, I wrote that down before Jed said it, so I'm going to tell that joke. So Jesus says to her in verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And then he asks her, do you believe this about me? And Martha reveals such bold faith in this terribly painful time. Verse 27, yes, Lord, she replied, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. So she's saying, yes, Lord, I believe in you, even though it's hard. Even though it hurts. And Martha runs ahead to get Mary, and she's brokenhearted as well. So Mary comes out to meet Jesus. Verse 32, when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. So she just collapses at his feet in grief. And I know, both as a pastor and, as a fireman in my previous life, I think I might have mentioned to you guys before, I used to be a fireman. Anyway, I've seen people who've lost a loved one. And when they just fall into one another's arms and sob. And I've been at the hospital as, someone has passed and another person enters the room, a family member, and it just plays over again. In moments like that, there's this need to touch another living soul. And seeing those that he loves in such deep pain, even though he knows what he's about to do about it, Jesus' heart is ripped out in verse 32. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And that deeply moved is he was angry. And troubled, he's agitated. And some commentators believe that he's feeling this way because of their lack of faith. But I think it's more likely that he is angry at death and illness, which were not part of the original creation. And then in verse 34, Jesus asks, "Where have you laid him?" "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And then the shortest verse in the Bible, the verse that everyone memorizes and when you're in a scripture memory contest as a kid, verse 35, Jesus wept. Jesus is God, but he's fully human, we can see here. And I like to think that Jesus still weeps when he sees us in grief. In verses 38 through 44, Lazarus is raised. Jesus arrives at the tomb, which is a true heart-stopping moment of terror, disbelief, and overwhelming joy all at once. And we're just going to let the scene from The Chosen tell this part of the story for us.
"I say to you again, remove the stone." "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me."
"Sent? What is he doing?"
"He already told us last night, you don't remember?"
"He said so that we and many others might believe in him."
"We already believe in him.
And for everything."
"Lazarus, come out."
Awesome. Man, can you imagine? We just did, actually. So believe it or not, in verses 45 through 53, there's mixed reviews on what just happened. John lays out this stark difference in response to Lazarus being raised from the dead. In verse 45, "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him." So those that knew and loved Lazarus and his sisters are obviously quite thrilled at this and they believe in Jesus, and you would think that that would be the response, right? Especially of the religious leaders, that this man is made whole, this family's made whole, but no, there are other motives at play here. There's another response. The Sanhedrin Council calls for a meeting, and we've talked about the council here before. They're the ruling body over Jewish affairs under the oversight of Rome, kind of like Jewish Supreme Court. And like today, it's made up of, you know, conservatives and liberals. There are the Pharisees, who are highly religious, and their philosophy is to maintain separation between culture and their religion. And there's the Sadducees, who are intensely political, often compromising and accommodating to the Roman government. And most of the council members have other concerns that are more important to them than Lazarus's well-being. Number one being that they will lose followers and their influence. Number two, they have political concerns. Jesus could cause problems with their political base and backing. Verse 48, they say, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. In other words, Rome will see this as upsetting the peace and will put the hammer down on the council's ability to direct and judge affairs. And then the high priest, which is kind of like the chief justice of the council, says the secret thing out loud. And verse 50 says, it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. In other words, better him than us. It's better that Jesus die than we have trouble with the Romans. And this is pure political expediency on their part. And his cynicism proves to actually be a profound truth, because that is exactly what will happen. As Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 5:14, we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died. So just like a broken clock is right twice a day, even a cynical hypocrite can get it right on occasion, although I don't think he meant it in the way that Paul meant it. And then lastly, verses 54 through 57, Jesus goes undercover. He will give his life willingly, but not at this time. In verse 54, therefore Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. And John explains this in his commentary on that in verse 57. The chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. And that's as far as we'll go today. So there's a lot to absorb from this passage. Maybe you've already been thinking of some things. You've made connections. But I have a few thoughts for this. And first, I want to just present one big thought that I think wraps this up. And then I want to support that thought with a few other comments. And here's my big idea. Jesus is all-powerful, and he's compassionate in a deeply personal way. Jesus is all-powerful, and he's compassionate in a deeply personal way. Number one, he's powerful. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. He was clearly dead, not mostly dead. He didn't swoon, or he wasn't sleeping, or he wasn't unconscious or unresponsive. He was dead and decaying. And as the Son of God, Jesus' power over death is absolute. He said in verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. That is, I don't just do resurrection, I am the resurrection. So death has no power over Jesus. And the Bible testifies that Jesus' own resurrection was witnessed by hundreds, including many who suffered martyrdom for refusing to deny what they saw with their own eyes. But this passage shows us more than the resurrection power of Jesus. It reveals something else. And Jesus is compassionate. What makes Jesus cry? The Gospels record at least three instances of Jesus crying. One, in the Garden of Gethsemane, as he wept over the suffering he was about to experience. Two, as he overlooked the city of Jerusalem with compassion on the people that had fallen away. And then here, He's deeply moved by the broken hearts of Mary and Martha. I don't think he was crying over Lazarus specifically, because he knew that he would be together with him for all eternity, and he was about to raise him back to life. You know, when Jesus was greeted by Martha and Mary, John says Jesus wept. Some versions read, he burst into tears. Why? Because of their grief. The God of the universe, the Creator, shares in the grief of these two obscure women in first century Judea. Jesus is all-powerful and compassionate in a deeply personal way. So how does that affect you and me today? How does that matter? Why does that matter to you and me? Here's three supporting thoughts. Number one, we do not have to fear death. When Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, he demonstrated his ultimate power over life and death. And the hope of the gospel is that when this life ends, it is not the end. And when Jesus spoke of his death, he gave his disciples these comforting words in John 14, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have not told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and I will take you to be with me so that you also may be where I am." You know, as Christians, we know that after this life, we will spend eternity with Jesus along with others who have believed. So what is there to fear? This should comfort us when we lose loved ones. It's not to say that the momentary separation that we experience isn't extremely, extraordinarily painful. For 7 years, my youngest daughter lived up in Fresno. They just moved back at Christmas. But we would go up there and see our grandkids, you know. That's one reason to go to Fresno. I can't think of others, but we would go there, and sorry for all my Fresno people. And every time we would leave, our grandkids would cry. Yeah, I kind of felt good about that. Yeah, these grandkids love us, you know, these ones in town, they're just used to us. But they would cry, it would make me cry. And if I say cry, will you guys keep saying, oh, cry? That's so awesome. So, but, you know, like, we knew we were going to see them again, right? Maybe their little minds couldn't understand completely that, but we understood, and we're still crying. So that momentary separation, that period of time, it is painful. We can't just be numb to that. We grieve at a temporary loss, but it is temporary. We don't need to fear death. Number two, if only you had and come and see are good prayers. These are good prayers. Martha's first words to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." She's not bitter. It doesn't sound like. She's mournful. You can hear the disappointment in her words. "You could have done this for me, Lord." And Mary's even more expressive, as we noted. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." In that moment, as much as she believed in Jesus, Mary is not standing tall in her faith. She collapses in his presence. Both Mary and Martha believed in Jesus, but neither could understand why he didn't come sooner. They invite Jesus into their greatest pain. "Come and see, Lord." They bring him to the tomb and are like, "Yeah, right there it is. This is what's happened, and I don't understand how you could let this happen. Can't you see it, Lord?" Because I've kind of been wondering whether you do. If only you and come and see our good prayers, because Jesus is not just all powerful. He's compassionate in a deeply personal way. Paul wrote this in Romans 8:26. We do not know what we ought to pray, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. Do you ever pray prayers like that? You ever pray, come and see, Lord, prayers? Like, come and see, Lord, my wife in the hospital bed right now. Or come and see, Lord, my dad is in a dementia care facility. Or come and see my child who's struggling at school right now. Or come and see that guy that ripped me off in my business partnership. Come and see, Lord, how little is left in my checking account. There's also if only prayers. If only you had been here, Lord, this would not have happened. If only you had showed up. If only you had her work harder, she wouldn't have flunked out of college. If only you had given me that job or that promotion. Or if only you had just made my husband stay. There's other versions of these grief-stricken prayers like, God, this is so hard. I'm mad at you, God. Are you there? Where were you? Why did you wait 2 days before traveling from Bethany? Those are real prayers. And it is normal to sometimes struggle with God's plan when we don't understand, because we won't always understand. Often we don't understand. Often we're incapable of understanding. But we have an all-powerful God who is deeply compassionate in a personal way. Last, number three, instead of looking backward in doubt, Jesus invites us to look forward in belief. Instead of looking backward in doubt, Jesus invites us to look forward in belief. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Verse 26, whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Verse 40, did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? Grief, fear, bitterness, hatred can paralyze us. It leaves us stuck, unable to take the next step. It's okay and it's right and it's healthy to remain still and wait on the Lord. But often God's glory is right around the next turn. But we won't see it unless we move on. You see, nothing happens unless someone steps up to roll away the stone. Jesus required someone to act before he revealed what God had in store. And I know that right now some of you are wondering if you'll ever be able to move on. I'm going to ask the band to come up. And while they're coming up, I want to ask you a question. What has you stuck? Is it fear? Self-pity? Failure? Loneliness? Worry? Loss? Is it time to move forward in belief? Your divorce was devastating. Is it time to move on? To get back out there. You know, you failed that certification test 3 times now. Is it time maybe to try it once more? You were wounded deeply at your last church, so you keep your distance right now. Is it time to re-engage? You're in a toxic relationship and you're afraid to move on. Is it time yet to cut it loose? The loss of your loved one has been so incredibly painful and lonely. But is it time to move forward with your life as it is now? What's keeping you from moving forward in belief that God has something for you? Yes, linger in grief. Sit still in your anxiety. Worry over what your life looks like now. That's good. It's okay. But don't stay there. Don't spend the rest of your days looking back. Move forward in belief, because this story reminds us that Jesus is all-powerful and he is compassionate, and God's glory may just be one step away. Let's stand and worship together. Hey everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.